first of all, in some general way, what do you feel might be the critical factors that led to Beveridge and to the idea of the National Health Service in the first place?
Well, of course, the National Health Service idea figured prominently in the Beveridge report, although at the time, and I think in it, in the discussions before, other parts of the whole Beveridge plan played a much bigger part, that is, all the national insurance parts, and in a kind of sense way, the development of the ideas of a National Health Service took place in a rather different manner, although I'm not trying to depreciate the impetus that Beveridge gave to it as well. But there was a different conception in the National Health Service from the Beveridge plan itself. The Beveridge plan was primarily based on the insurance principle in one sense or another, and of course the National Health Service was based on a different principle, the principle that the payment should be out of taxation, and that was one of the primary matters on which Nyrin Bevan insisted most strongly and most rightly. I think he influenced it greatly in that respect, in the sense that if it had not been partly for his influence, there might have been an attempt by some people to keep the insurance principle in some form or other, or retain it in the health service. But he was adamant that we should move to the national taxation system, and indeed he hoped, I have no doubt, that there would become a time when the whole of the payment of the service was from taxation, and people should be able to see it in that way. If we put the question around another way, how would the National Health Service have developed if there had not been Nyrin Bevan's influence or the Labour government's influence, and it was primarily his influence in that Labour government affecting it after 1945? I think it would have been a very pathetic imitation of a National Health Service if it had been left to the ideas that were round about the place prior to the arrival of the Labour government in power in 1945 and prior to the arrival of Nyrin Bevan at the National at the Ministry of Health. I discussed the matter with many of those, of course, with whom he was associated when I was writing my book about him, and in particular I discussed it with some of the civil servants with whom he worked, and they gave me the very clear impression that the whole direction of the service and the preparation for the service was transformed by his arrival at the Department of Health, he changed the way in which the preparations were made. One of the principles that he insisted on most strongly, although, well, I'm not saying it wasn't present in the previous ideas, it was, but he insisted on it most strongly, that was that the payment for the service must be through taxation and not on an insurance principle. But the more he looked at it, the more he believed that it got to be a real national scheme, and it wouldn't be satisfactory to try and thread together the existing forms of health service with the local authorities continuing to play the part that they had done before. He got into a lot of trouble with a lot of local authorities and spokesmen for local authorities for insisting so strongly on that principle. But I'm sure most people, I think, looking back would say that he was absolutely right. There would never have been a national health service if it had not been started on a national basis and taken therefore out of the hands of those who were previously running hospitals, whether they were voluntary ones or the local authority ones. I'm not saying the local authority hospitals weren't well conducted, many of them were, or that some of the other hospitals weren't well conducted, but if there was going to be any national scheme, it had to be done that way. And of course the finance that was required to make a national health service was so great that it could only come from the state. Now, Nyrin Bevan's, one of his main pressures was to ensure that the national scheme should take precedence, and then he had great quarrels in the cabinet, in the government, and with many who had didn't like the idea of seeing their losing the local authorities, seeing their losing their control over the hospitals they had, and particularly, of course, that was the case here in London, where Herbert Morrison, with some natural instincts on the matter, in the light of what had happened in the past, was not very enthusiastic about that proposal. But that was one of the decisive changes, and a decisive change that was made in the plans that had been prepared previously to the arrival of the Labour government in power in 1945. Those plans had never envisaged a national scheme on the full national basis that he attempted. But above all, I suppose, his the originality and the importance of the way he went about it was the way he dealt with the medical profession itself. That was an aspect of the matter that attracted the most attention at the time, but it was also of fundamental importance, because whatever the medical profession might say later on, or the bulk of it, there's not the slightest doubt that the bulk of the medical profession as represented in their BMA especially opposed the scheme, and of all that is fully documented, and it was because of their bitter opposition in many quarters to the whole scheme that the Conservative Party here in the House of Commons took up that opposition, and the people forget, but not merely did they vote against the second reading of a bill, which is what opposition parties do on matters of major principle, but they even voted against the third reading of the National Health Service Bill, which if they'd accepted the way in which it had been done, and if they were generally accepting the proposals, would not have been the natural course. The reason why they did so, my belief, and everybody's belief at the time, was that they thought that the actual scheme could be stopped and would be stopped, and that the opposition of sections of the medical profession was so great that it would be blocked. Well, and Aaron Bevan's skill in dealing with the matter circumvented that, partly because he got on his side very important sections of the medical profession, the Royal Society of Physicians and the Royal Society of the Surgeons, came round to his side, or not all of them together, but several of the most prominent leaders amongst them. And so the British Medical Association, despite the fact that it was led by the formidable Charles Hill, who was really fighting to preserve his own reputation as well as the strength of his BMA's position, and he was a skillful operator, but nonetheless, Aaron Bevan outmaneuvered them, and when at various times their opposition became so strong, Aaron Bevan came back to the House of Commons here, which was the place where he resorted time and again to get the authority to proceed with his negotiations. Even so, the pressures on him to retreat or to hold up the date were very great indeed. And in the, people may forget now, but right up to July the 5th, 1948, when it came into being, many people were prophesying that the service wouldn't come into operation with anything like full backing either of the medical profession or of the patients. But what happened when it was launched was within a few weeks, instead of it being only 50, 60, 70% of the eligible patients applying to become as patients for eligible possible patients for the National Health Service, the figures were up to 90% or more. And of course that the doctors themselves had to accept that, but it was a very close-run thing, and many people prophesied that he was going to fail in getting the service into operation, and I think there were some of his colleagues who'd been critical of him, some of the colleagues in the Labour government who hadn't wished to see the National Health Service taking such a priority as it did. I think some of them would have, at any rate, looked with equanimity if he'd got into difficulties in the foundation of the scheme. But it was a tremendous success, and I believe it was due primarily to having a Labour government coming in, but within that, I think it was primarily due to the appointment of Aaron Bevan as the spokesman on it, or the as the one in charge. If that had not been the case, I don't believe the National Health Service would have been introduced in that form then. There were many people also who argued that it should be introduced in piecemeal, and that it shouldn't be introduced on the same day, and that it shouldn't include anything about a dental service and an optical service as well. There again, Nauyen Bevan was absolutely insistent that he wanted to get the whole scheme as comprehensive as possible in the way it was introduced, because he believed that if you didn't succeed in doing that then, all the more difficult would have been to do it later on. And I must say the experience we've had since confirms what he said. It was difficult enough to get it's been difficult enough to preserve anything like a decent dental service or a decent optical service over the years subsequently. But if it hadn't been initiated at the beginning, there wouldn't have been any chance whatsoever. But that's only a very brief account, I may say, of some of the problems that he faced. It was, biggest domestic political fight of that Labour government. It was bitterly opposed by the Conservatives of the day, led by Winston Churchill, and they opposed the scheme because they thought that they were going to win, and they thought that because they had friends in the medical profession who thought that it was not going to command the support of the medical profession, and that was what happened up to then. But when I was writing my book some years later about how it had been founded, and when I did what maybe you've been doing of going around of talking to many of the people who were associated in the production of the whole scheme, I found a very big transformation in their attitude, and a very big transformation, I must say, in their attitude to Nauyen Bevan himself. I think most of the leaders of the medical profession with whom I talked, including some of those who had been bitterly hostile to him in the actual negotiations, became converted not merely to him, but converted to the scheme. Guy Dane, who was the secretary of the British Medical Association, whom I went up and interviewed when he was in his 90s somewhere up in Birmingham, he was took a very different view about it then, I think, than from the time when he was in the fight. And then there was another chap, Cockcroft, who led some of the fiercest fights from the British Medical Association and was one of their prominent spokesmen in the negotiations. When I went to interview him, he spoke to me most glowingly, not only about Nauyen Bevan's qualities, but about the transformation in his outlook about the National Health Service. And he genuinely said, I mean, he was a fully qualified and most eminent doctor, but he said he'd never imagined what it was going to be like. And of course, people today, I don't believe, can imagine what it was like before the National Health Service had been started. We take it for granted that people can get lots of services without having to pay for them, and that you don't have to worry about doctor's bills. Well, in those days, most people had to worry about doctor's bills, and amongst the people who worried were the doctors themselves, who were all the time having to discriminate between their patients as to whether they made them pay or didn't make them pay.
Well, I think we should turn it over to
them.
What were the concessions, do you think, Mr. Foote? I mean, were they substantial in relation, for example, to the 100% salaried service, which was part of the 45 manifesto, and which perhaps necessarily Bevan couldn't?
Well, I don't think there was the slightest chance of his getting the 100% salaried service, and if he tried to get it, then I think the opposition of the doctors would have been absolutely implacable and insurmountable, and he would have not been able to create any divisions amongst the doctors. He would not have been able to capitalize the support that he did have. The chief ally that he had amongst the doctors themselves was the head of the Royal College of Physicians, Lord Moran, Churchill's doctor, who was a supporter of the health service. He was also, no doubt, critical and jealous of the British Medical Association, and such factors played a part in it. But he was genuinely eager to try and see a National Health Service established, and genuinely eager to try and get persuade the consultants, both the physicians and the surgeons, to play a major part in it. And don't forget, one of the major things or major achievements of the health service is to spread medical knowledge and medical experience and skill more fairly throughout the country. We now take it for granted that if you go to a hospital like ours in Neville Hall outside in Wales, in Abergavenny, that you get the very best consultant skills there in a whole variety of different fields, and that same thing applies in many of the great hospitals up and down the country. That was not the situation in the old hospital system before the creation of the National Health Service. Most of the skills were concentrated in a very few places, in London in particular, but in some of the teaching hospitals that were concentrated in very, very few places. Well, that was spread throughout the whole country, and to get that, Nyren Bevan had to get the support and the cooperation of the consultants, and Moran was one of the keys to the way he got it, although not the sole one, because I think he got the others from the College of Surgeons and the gynecologists as well to come along in the same way. They wanted to see a proper chance of using their medical skills, and they knew that they had to have state money on a huge scale in order to be able to achieve it. So, and then they were, I think many of them, aghast at the opposition that was shown by the British Medical Association, which was insisting on the maintenance of private practice and insisting on a whole range of items which would have blocked any national health service. So he had to overcome that. But to think he could have overcome them, come it, that opposition without any allies in the medical profession itself was an absurdity. And I think he measured the gauged that situation from the beginning. So, and I don't believe that most of the people in the Socialist Medical Association and others, for example, who were backing the bill and the whole project, of course, most strongly, although they were critical, they didn't, in my opinion, think that that was a fatal compromise. He would have made, no doubt, struck the compromise in a somewhat different way if he had the chance, and he always hoped that it was going to develop more in the direction of the national service and that there wouldn't be the the revival of private practice on the scale that there has been. I'm sure he never envisaged anything like that.
Could you say something about that? I mean, just as a sort of final question, the thing does have a large element of private practice within it, and this is part of the, as it were, the contradiction that was there at the permanent period of its foundation, probably necessarily so. Nonetheless, it is developing alarmingly. Do you think that there are signs of a crisis within the service now that reflect its foundations?
Well, I of course, it is simply and logically, if there had been no private practice left in the service at all, well, it would have been impossible maybe for it to develop. But it couldn't have been achieved in 1948, and I don't believe anybody, however critical on the left, who about it could have imagined that it could have been achieved. It wouldn't have been started at all. The whole thing would have been blocked if that had been the aim. Something else. What was yours?
Just the question of what of whether this whether this is deepened. I mean, this was a necessary.
Yeah, no, but if you take the present situation of the service and contrast it with the situation, then of course there are many developments that Nyren Bevan would have greatly deplored and which the Labour government of that time would have greatly deplored. But I don't think we should just look on it in that field. There are many of the things that are happening in the National Health Service now which spring from the way in which he did it, which we should take credit. I mean, if you take the new hospitals that are being built, the provision for, not for privacy, but for, and not for specialized or privilege or anything of the sort, but the provision for people to be treated in separate rooms or in separate places in many of these new hospitals in the way that they are built, and the provision for everybody who gets a place in the hospital to have the chance of getting that kind of treatment, especially in dealing with the most serious kinds of diseases, is very great indeed, far greater in my opinion than public, so sometimes the general public criticisms allow. That doesn't mean to say that I don't think there aren't lots of deficiencies in the service, and of course that there requires lots more to be spent on the service. The question of what's spent on the service was also, of course, an absolutely major matter of argument at the time of the foundation of the service and in the subsequent few years. And Irene Bevan always said, well, you mustn't blame me for that. We won't be able to see exactly what the service is going to cost until we can test it in practice. And he was always furious with the Treasury officials who came along to him and said that he'd underestimated the amount and that when he demanded some supplementary estimates. But he said, well, look, let's test it for a year. You'll find out in a year, and then you can base your estimates on some proper form. But until we've shown the thing in practice, we won't know exactly how it's going to be used. But of course, if you look back at to those days, and compare it with the amount that's spent now, the changes are fantastic. And forms of medical equipment and medical knowledge that have taken place since, and the cost of them, are absolutely huge and inexhaustible almost. And of course he did foresee that those dangers, or difficulties, not dangers, difficulties that would arise. But I don't think anybody could have estimated exactly how huge that was going to be. And I must say, when I go into a hospital myself, as I was in a year or so ago, and I was having something done to my eyes, I was trying to calculate it, what it would have cost, the equipment and the kind of provision that you had day by day. I mean, the cost of it is absolutely enormous, and private people couldn't possibly pay it. And if we were going to have services in this country in which that was to be all taken away from the mass of the population, we would bring the whole provision of proper services in the hospitals to a standstill. So although there are deficiencies, and although much more needs to be spent on it, and although there's a lot to be done in the service, don't underestimate what has been achieved. The thing is fabulous achievement compared with what was the provision, hospital provision and health provision prior to 1945. And it covers, of course, the whole population now, when previously, before 1945, it only covered a very small number who happened to have paid their money into different insurance schemes.